With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You are listening to Myst Apex iRacing Podcast. Let's get faster. Welcome to Myst Apex iRacing Podcast, part of the Myst Apex Motorsport Podcast and Content Network. Find all our stuff at mystapex.net. I'm your host, Richard Spanners Ready, and I'm joined by, in iRating order, Brad Philpott. How's it going, Brad?
Good evening, Spanners. It's going really well. Happy to sit down and chat to you guys about some esports.
Okay, so we're going in iRating order. Do you want to flex your iRating for us?
I think it's 6.6K at the moment. I'm trying to build it back up, so aiming for 7.
6.6K? What percentage does that put you in?
I don't know. I think it's top 30 in the UK, around that.
Blimey. All right, well, Matt, two rumpets, you're not top 30 in Brooklyn, are you?
No, but I'm over 2,000, so that's not exactly.
Oh, that's a flex. So you're higher than me. I am currently at 1,900, and I discovered a weird thing. After last week saying that my safety rating was in the twos, because, you know, we were talking about me getting my A license. It's right. Over 3, isn't it, for it to be automatic at the end of the season? I think so. And then it's 4 for an immediate promotion. So we found out yesterday that iRating doesn't just do safety rating based on like the race you've had and the incidents you've had entirely. It also does little jumps to stop you going up and down licenses. So I was at 2.9 yesterday and I had a very clean race. I think I had a 0x and it jumped straight up to 3.65.
Yeah, whenever you get around going up a whole number or down a whole number, it'll bump you an extra half a point. Just to cut down on the noise and make sure that it's signal.
Did you know that, Brad?
No, I had no idea. But that's also because, as I've mentioned before, I haven't thought about safety rating in about 5 years.
So I'm now optimistic that my A license will just kind of appear. I've got all the MPR. I've done the 4 qualifying races now. And after Alton Park and Zolder, which just destroyed safety rating, actually the last 2 tracks have been all right, haven't they? Imola? No, Imola was terrible because it was death by 1x. But Canada, surprisingly, I thought Montreal in the F3 would just be carnage. But the 2 races I've done, it's been all right, Matt. It's been quite civil. If you can avoid the trouble, you're not 1x, 1x, 1x because there's a wall there.
Yeah, it's usually just the first lap, cold tires, just got to kind of be a little bit careful. And after that, I've noticed. And I don't know if it's just because I'm in a different split than last season, but it does seem like the driving standards have gotten a little bit better in the F3.
Less
worse. Slightly less of the crazy.
Slightly less worse, although it was coming from a very crazy place. Are you doing much F3 at the moment, Brad?
I'm not doing much anything. I haven't actually had a simulator in the last 3 weeks, and I haven't done F3 for a long time, even when I had it. So when I eventually get it back, it will be Formula One again, I guess. Maybe some Formula Renault 3.5. People are trying to entice me into that.
Okay, so the appealing thing about the Formula Renault 2.0 and the F3 is there's quite a big size of field. If you go there in the evening, you're going to have at least 5 or 6 splits in the F3, maybe 3 or 4 in the Formula Renault 2.0. And then in the Mazdas, in the MX-5, I really like that because there was like 12. So you're guaranteed kind of close racing. In the F1, it's generally one split, isn't it? And it doesn't always go official. Do you not find that that just means you get a bit of a like a rubbish field spread?
It just means that all the races through the week are practice races. So,
all right.
So you just don't need to worry too much about them if they don't go official. Just use them as a practice.
So you've gone soft and you're just doing unofficial races to save your safety rating and your
eye. It basically means when I do the race, the big race of the week, it really counts and you're very well prepared for it. And you just pay lots of attention to it. So you're just very well practiced when you enter it.
So what's the situation with the Renault 3.5 then? Is that also sparsely populated? And who is strong arming you over there?
So I think it's much more highly populated than the Formula One. I think it's very, it is quite a popular series. I haven't actually tried them in a few years, so I don't know whether they're any good. I know you get a certain number of DRS uses per race, so it's kind of like you can save them up and use them when you want, I believe. But I'm being strong-armed by my friend Tom, who I do quite a lot of single-seater races with, but also Ramon Pinheiro, who keeps raving about them.
Is it faster than the F3 then?
Yes, it's kind of Formula 2 levels of speed, so it's one step below the F1.
Okay, so that's interesting. In the Mist Apex series and Swarm, as a group, we started off with the MX-5, moved to the Renault 2.0, and then the F3. I had assumed that the natural progression would eventually maybe be the F1. So I'll be interested to see if you think the 3.5 is a step up.
Yeah, I think because they're naturally aspirated and they've just got a lot of grip as well, aero and mechanical, I hear that they're just really good fun. So I'll just reserve judgment until I've actually done it. So looking forward to giving it a try. But I do find, I don't know about you guys, I need to focus on one series to do well at it. If I'm jumping in all different cars, I'm never good enough to, you know, never happy with my performance. I'd rather just focus for a whole week on one particular car.
So from a content point of view, I've been trying to just jump in and do more stuff or at least explore iRacing. So I had a brief fascination with the Lucas Oil trucks on the Rallycross, jumping over those big jumps. I've been trying out doing ovals as well. The kids, my two kids, my 9-year-old and 10-year-old, are really into the ovals at the moment. They've been kind of reigniting their love for jumping into the sim. But the ovals are great because it's something they can just do without being too discouraged. When you do the road courses, the braking is by far the hardest aspect of iRacing and the hardest aspect to get right. So I've been putting my little V, my 9-year-old, into the MX-5 at the Charlotte Roval. But before I did that, I jumped in and I tried to do an MX-5 race. And after a lap, I was like, it doesn't brake. It doesn't turn. I hate it. But I remember when we were doing MX-5s, Brad, you were already very, very experienced in iRacing in general. And you came and sort of almost charitably jumped on our MX-5 sessions. What was that like going kind of back down to the rookie road class?
Yeah, it was a while ago now, but I just remember it felt exactly as you just described. It's just everything feels worse. It feels like the car isn't doing what you're telling it to because you've become so accustomed to something which is responsive that slows down quickly, turns when you tell it to turn, doesn't need that much steering lock, just has loads more grip. So yeah, I always find it harder going down to a car like that that's on road tires, no downforce, and just feels slow. It's like, it feels like you're driving around with the brakes on.
But Matt, I remember at the time doing those MX-5s, it definitely didn't feel like that going up. And I think this is the theme with iRacing progression. On the way up, everything feels, you know, intense. It felt so realistic. But when I went back, it felt like a toy car almost.
Well, I think it's just you get used to things coming at you more quickly. And I think, as Brad says, that you can get very dialed into a single car and then any other car is not going to feel good because it's simply you're having to think more about making it do what you want. You're having to relearn how to manipulate the car into doing what you want. Yeah. But yeah. I will say, I think the MX-5 they have now is a far sight better than the one we were racing. Because I was in one not too long ago. I was like, oh, this drives a lot better than I remember it driving. So either I've improved tremendously or they've gotten the models to a little bit closer to reality.
Maybe. So I'm getting little V into it. And you'll probably notice this with kids on kart tracks as well, is once they turn into a corner, they keep turned, if that makes sense. So they keep the steering lock on, get the accelerator on, and then spin. And you'll see it at any kart track, in even with grown-ups in a rental kart. So I'm coaching her and I'm like, right, get it turned into the apex. And I see that she's turning and she's about to spin. And I couldn't think of like the words. So I'm like, right, open up the steering. She's like, huh? What do you mean open up the steering? So I went, unsteer, unsteer. And she got that and she unsteered. So there's me yelling at my 9-year-old, steer, unsteer, brake, steer, unsteer. And now in my head, when I'm trying to stop myself oversteering on exit, I'm hearing my own voice yelling, unsteer. And it's the equivalent of righty-tighty.
Yeah, we've gone over this before, I'm sure, but it's so important for people to make sure they are aware of where they're telling the car to go, and yeah, that they know that the car is going to go where you point the front wheels. So it's pretty crucial that you're telling it the direction that you actually want to go, not where you wanted to go 2 seconds ago before something else happened and distracted you. So that's one of the key things people need to be aware of.
It's interesting with the kids, like the instinct to turn into the corner is there, but the instinct to turn out of a corner isn't there. Like you have to deliberately go for the exit. So that's been fascinating revisiting it with them. All right, so let's get to the meat of today's show. We are going to talk about some rig stuff, because Brad is in a strange rig situation. I'm in a dual rig situation, as I'm between rigs and I'm yet to sell the old one. So I did a side by side between old and new. But first, I want to talk a little bit about attacking and defending. Now, did you catch me and Van Gene's Barcelona video where we tried to kind of do a little demo video of a lap around Barcelona?
Yes, I did, although I cannot remember specifics, so okay. You're going to have to refresh me.
So the Barcelona was where we did our round three of the Mist Apex F3 series, and instead of doing a hot lap at the beginning of the broadcast, me and Van Gien put together a lap where it was basically Van Gien was about half a second a lap down on me because he had colder tyres and more fuel. So even though I had pace on him, as you have said in the past, I have zero racecraft. So the video is basically me trying to get around Van Gien and trying to find ways to poke and prod inside, outside, and him masterfully against weak opposition, just defending. And I think if I had had 100 laps in that situation, I was not getting past him. So just interesting, like even as my pace has increased a bit, my racecraft hasn't. And I think that is my next point of focus.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, you don't have to go back to that example where I once, several years ago, said that your racecraft wasn't amazing.
No. Hang on. You didn't say that. Let's be very clear here. You went, I came off of a heat in a kart circuit, and you went, wow, Spanners, you have absolutely no racecraft at all. And I was like, oh, okay. That's definitely stuck in my head.
I think with karting and sim racing combined now, though, you probably have exponentially increased your experience level. So I'd be surprised if you were at the same point as you were back then.
Okay, but Alex Van Gien, a seasoned karter and sim racer, just had an answer for everything I was trying to do. Now, Barcelona, I think, is a track in particular where you can defend around the outside. So that probably exacerbated it. But he could see the moves coming. So like, I went wide into turn four at Barcelona, at the top of the hill, the tight sort of hairpin right-hander, and I went wide thinking I'll undercut. He sees that and just lifts just enough to stop me cutting back. And, you know, then into the next turn, I try and dive down deep. He sees that coming. He makes sure he's going around the outside. So just, yeah, I mean, there's not really a question there. It's just the discussion of why can't I beat Van Gien?
Yeah, so I was wondering how you were going to pose this to me and exactly what the question was going to be.
Tell me how to beat Van Gien.
This is one of those subjects which is a little bit less straightforward to explain than some of the how to drive fast things and techniques we've spoken about in the past, because each racing scenario is quite different from another. And you really need to know the absolute specifics of that particular battle and the positioning of each car in order to comment on what you could have done differently, you know, how to defend a particular move. But we can certainly try and talk in general. But bearing in mind, these things are quite organic.
Of course. And that's great because it means we can break it down and we can start off general and then break it down into several tiers over several episodes. But Matt, I always feel like in the pack, you're a little bit more aggressive and a bit more decisive than I am. And I will find if I am in a pack in a train of equally paced drivers, generally I'll find myself falling back because I don't want to cut them off and have a crash. I don't tend to go up the inside. Do you know what I mean? I'm just less decisive. And in that equally paced train, I'll just end up at the back of it.
Well, I am glad that I've managed to give you that impression, because I'll be honest, it does not always feel like that when you're in the midst of a heated battle. I don't know. For me, there's two judgments I make. Is this person fundamentally faster than me? And how far away am I from the finish given that information? And if the person is fundamentally faster and I'm not even halfway through the race, once they get a sniff, once they get alongside, I judge it to be less risk to simply let them go rather than risk crashing, trying to defend a position that I'm almost certainly going to lose down the line anyway.
You've definitely got to assess your opponent, haven't you? So if, so for example, in the F3 at the moment, as much as we were saying it's not crashy, about a third of the field does end up either spinning or crashing out, and then, or not qualifying. There seems to be a trend for not qualifying, or the guys who just fluff both their quali laps. So if there's a name that wasn't on your relative box 2 laps ago, and then suddenly he's within 2 seconds, yeah, I'll just let that guy go. But Brad, you at the very kind of top end of pace, is there ever any times where you go, it's not worth a pass here, or is it always finding a way by?
If you are faster and you've caught a car, regardless of what stage of the race you're at, if they are in a position where they're going to be holding you up because, you know, you've caught them on pace, unless there was a real reason for you to wait, like you were saving fuel or something to that effect, you would always go for it, really. You know, and you'd actually want to do it sooner rather than later, because particularly in single seaters, downforce dependent cars, you're going to start damaging your tires the longer you're sat behind them. And obviously, if they're holding you up, then they're holding you up. You don't want to be losing time in general in the race. It's slightly different as well in the Formula One that I drive, because the tires are quite fragile. So being in someone's aero wake does damage your tires pretty quickly. So again, you have to be quite decisive in when you make the move.
And I guess you don't often find yourself in the position that me and Matt do, where suddenly someone who was 10 seconds behind is behind you. But I'm imagining you have experience maybe in the VRS having to defend faster drivers.
I'm often having to defend faster drivers, particularly actually when the strategies overlap. If someone's on a fresh set of tyres, yeah, or if you're on an old set of tyres, something like that. But even just in general, I'm not the very fastest person out there. So obviously we're all in splits relative to our ability. So I will quite often be in splits with some very, very quick people who are just quicker than me. And you do have to... you have to make a decision on how early in the race you are. Do you want to fight this particular battle, or is it better to wait until, you know, be quick as possible for as long as possible and fight the people who you're realistically battling later in the race?
Well, this mirrors my experience in the Nordschleife race, because after my pit stops, I was in the GT4, but I got stuck in amongst the leaders of the TCR class.
Is that faster, slower? Slower.
Slower.
Brad's saying more or less the same.
Yeah, quite often TCR and GT4 cars are kind of lumped into the same category in lots of motorsport because they're so similar on pace. But I take it in iRacing, the GT4 is a little bit quicker.
Okay, so you found yourself held up by a pack of slower cars.
Just a couple. And getting round them was really the most terrifying overtaking I had to do, because the people I were overtaking were at the front end of the slower field, and they were very good. And because I had pitted, we were racing for position. So they were not, it was not blue flags, let them go. And I wound up having to make some terrifying overtakes to get around them. They weren't going to hold me up because they knew my car was, you know, 10 seconds a lap faster, but they were not going to make it easy either.
Yeah. Okay. So that's multi-class. So for now, let's keep it easy and talk about when we're kind of in the same car. So something like F3 or Formula One, I guess. Let's start with why we lose time in the battle. So I think it might sound obvious. It's because you're having to take more track because you're not taking the quickest lines. But fighting at Montreal, for example, when who was it up ahead? It was Colin Ward. Colin was fighting up ahead with a group of three people. I could catch them when they were fighting, and I was like, maybe like 3 or 4 seconds a lap. As soon as they shuffled into an order and settled down, I couldn't touch them.
Yeah, so depending on how ferociously people are defending and battling, you can be losing a lot of time. And actually, you can lose it's quite a big range of how much time you can lose. I've quite often been in a position where I've been defending so hard and hanging someone right out to dry, and you could be losing seconds per corner in that situation. And then if it's just like a typical battle where someone's making a pass attempt and it doesn't come off and it's defended against, you can still be losing, you know, a second or a couple of seconds over a lap. So yes, definitely there's a lot of time loss. That's something to take into account as the attacker or the defender in any situation. You know, can you afford this time loss? Quite often, you know, there might be a train of cars approaching you that you are going to have to deal with the longer you defend from this particular person, whereas you might be able to make it to the end of the race just losing this one position if you don't fight them too hard. So you really do have to make a judgment call on what's best for your own race.
Yeah, and it can depend on like where's the main passing point on the track as well. So at Montreal, it's, you know, kind of the long back straight. If you're in touching distance from the final hairpin, you're going to get a chance down the back straight. So today, someone was behind me, but in sector one. So we've got all lap to go before we get to that long straight. So I make him follow me through the chicanes. I take it nice and easy. And by the time we get to sector three, the car behind him has caught him. And then all of a sudden, you see that gap disappear behind as well. So you can kind of use that to draw people in, if you like. But it's, yeah, it's interesting. It's that choice for me in the midfield as to whether to let the car go and then hope that means I fall down the train faster, or to try and, you know, shuffle them back and make their life problematic.
There are, of course, some situations where it's actually better to not be the leading car until you want to be. You know, maybe Spa, for example, that if you're not leading on the final lap, you're just tucked in second place. That can quite often be the best place to be, because you'll be able to slipstream past at the end of the Kemmel Straight, and then you're in front for all the part that they can't pass you through. So
yeah,
there's so many factors that come into this, and we haven't even got down to the nitty gritty of a battle itself and the track positioning.
No, not at all. This is still, should you have the battle? It's whether to yield or to have it. So as a quick aside today, someone was down the inside of me on that last hairpin at Montreal, and I thought, he's definitely going to get me down the back straight. I know what I'll do. I'll let him send it down the inside, go around the outside so that I've got the slipstream all the way down the back straight. It didn't work because I sort of fluffed the hairpin. But yeah, now we're starting to get into just really thinking about it, like actually having some 4D chess going on instead of just trying to go fast.
Yeah, and in that exact situation you're just talking about there, where you know you're approaching a crucial straight where the person behind is going to get a slipstream if they're, say, half a second behind you, you can very deliberately just allow them to get closer to you than the normal before you exit the corner. So maybe you exit and they are either right on your gearbox, so they don't have any time to really get a slipstream before they have to pull out. Or you can actually allow them partially alongside, so you're effectively in a drag race down the straight and they're not getting the benefit of actually having, you know, higher top speed.
That's nuts. So actually letting them be closer can be beneficial.
I do this frequently. Yeah, I mean, in the Formula One, anything where you are effectively causing, you know, to punch a hole in the air and they're going to get a nice slipstream from you, if they can be closer to you so that when they actually do make the pass, they don't have quite as much closing speed. So it's not as a decisive pass. Sometimes they'll pop out to make the pass and the drag will just slow them down enough that you're still a nose ahead by the next corner. Whereas if they'd been further back at the beginning of the straight, they would have had a stronger slipstream. They'd have had a higher speed differential between the two cars, and they'd have just pulled clear easily by the end of the straight.
I like this. I think we've naturally, Matt, gone into defending, which is great for you and me, because I think you and I are defending more than we're attacking, to be fair to us.
I would agree completely. And I love my own personal contribution, because we're talking about the hairpin at Montreal, is that if you've got someone, I like to just extend my braking zone a little bit, like by about 5 or 10 meters, but just enough to make them slow down a little bit more than they wanted to. And then I can get on the throttle early and create some separation while they're still trying to get around, because it's been my observation that there's two types of people around that hairpin: people who like to go into it really fast and people who like to go into it kind of slow and then get on the throttle early. I'm definitely more of the second type of person, but it seemed to work out very well as far as defending went, because I also had a setup that was really quick down that straight.
Oh, that's interesting. Because there's quite a lot on the exit, I've started V-ing that. So V it straight towards the corner, get it really kind of stopped and almost stopping in down into first gear. And then you've got a little bit of time to get it turned and twisted. And you get on the power quite early, but obviously you've got to then watch for it snapping. I saw loads of cars going round on exit there because, yeah, they've got the full lock on and they didn't have someone shouting unsteer at them. So ended up spinning. We're talking about defending here. And that reminds me of Luffield. So you've got Brooklands, Silverstone, and you've got Luffield, which is the right-hander that goes on forever. If you're in a battle there, Brad, and there's a car in front, sometimes you're waiting forever to get onto the power. You're waiting and you're waiting anyway. And the car in front of you, maybe he waits a little bit longer, he or she, beg your pardon. And that begs the question, How okay is it to linger? How okay is it to delay getting on the throttle? How okay is it to adjust your speed, like Matt said, in the braking zone, to affect the car behind?
Yeah, it's totally okay, provided you're not doing something so extreme that you give the person behind you no choice but to hit you. So in Luffield, I'd say probably the limit is actually braking. If you brake test the person, they're going to go in the back of you. You're causing some risk for yourself anyway at that point. But just hanging on and waiting to apply the throttle to inconvenience them is absolutely legitimate. So you can do that. You can brake earlier, like Matt said. What you don't want to do is be erratic and, you know, do something, like I mentioned, braking in the middle of Luffield, because you're just going to cause an accident.
I was just going to say, holy Botas, Batman. Slowing the field down to the last second and then stomping on the throttle when no one expects it.
Oh, you're referencing
what a genius plan.
The safety car at Portugal. But that's not a dissimilar analogy, is it? So the problem for the car behind is there's a natural expectation to accelerate. If let's keep Luffield as an example, where there's a period where you're kind of, us amateurs anyway, are on some amount of throttle, just waiting for the time when we can go full throttle. If you linger a bit too long, Brad, and I'm just expecting it or get impatient and then get on a very normal acceleration point and hit you, that's still my fault as the car behind.
Yeah, it is. You know, although as the driver in front, if you've done that tactic and you've been hit when you've been deliberately delaying the throttle, you kind of know what's happened there, don't you? So you can't be too angry at the other person. But yeah, it is their fault if they hit you from behind. But all you're doing is you're basically, first of all, being slightly unpredictable, so you're able to get the jump on them. It's similar to that Bottas analogy you guys just used. You know, the cars behind don't know when you're going to go, so they can't just anticipate and get on the power at the same time as you, as they normally would if you're just driving it normally. And you're also shortening the length of the following straight, so they've got less time sat behind you in order to slipstream their way past. You know, you're just waiting a little bit longer. There's a few fewer meters before the next braking zone.
You've got to trust the car behind. So if it's a series where you know the people, that's better.
Yeah, of course. And all of these things, any defensive or attacking maneuver is made all the easier if you trust the cars around you.
Okay, so I think we're right on the limit here of that feels like a little bit mucky. That feels like a slightly dark tactic. And we're talking like a heartbeat here, aren't you? Like you go into the chicane, you're taking the speed off, you're trail braking, and it's just a 1-2, just skipping a beat, just an octave. I don't really know music terms. I don't know why I'm using that. Just a bar, just a few beats, Matt, before you get back on the throttle. And that can be enough to just unsettle the car behind's plan.
Yeah, well, and it's the same thing with braking. If I normally brake at the 100 meter marker, and I brake at the 110 marker, and I brake a little easier and a little bit longer,
yeah,
the car from behind suddenly has greater closing speed, and they're going to have to, they're going to take more speed off than they want.
Yeah.
Just that little tiny bit. It's not, you're not really brake checking them.
Yeah.
You're simply taking a different trajectory into the turn that gives you the advantage exiting it.
And it's not just like, he's not doing his normal braking just from earlier, is he? He's lengthening it. So,
yeah, I haven't just stopped on my brakes at like the 3 marker instead of the 1 marker going into the final corner in Canada.
That was an accident. It's because in VR, it's not always crystal clear. So I broke at the 3 instead of the 2. Matt was a second behind me and he absolutely shimped and moaned for the rest of the race because he was behind and that let the guy in front close up. That was just a misjudgment. I'm very, very sorry, Brad.
So whilst we're on, so I like this. I like the way we're talking about this because we're straight into the things you're allowed to do, but they're a bit naughty. So this is good. This is a good topic. On this same subject, in terms of attacking, it's quite similar to when you feign a move, and I find this works a lot on iRacing. You feign a move that you are not going to attempt. You have no intention of dive bombing this person. But just at the last minute, you kind of hover in their mirrors and make a bit of a dart to the inside, totally under control. You know, you're not going to lose, you're not going to lock up a front wheel or anything. You're not going to hit them. You're just making it look in their mirrors like you might be diving down the inside. And quite often, if that driver is aware and they are paying attention to their mirrors, they will just leave a car's width, which they weren't going to do. And that suddenly opens up your overtaking opportunity, or at least some advantage to you for the next corner.
That works on me. If you do that on me, it works. And I don't know if this is a VR thing, but the objects in the little small virtual mirrors are way closer than the big bar mirror that you get at the top, to the point where I can't now not have those little pretend virtual mirrors on because it adds an element of realism. And when they're black now, it feels really, really strange. However, the object seems so close. So yes, if you pull out even from like half a second back, it looks like you're about to take a dive. So that tactic definitely works on me, Brad.
And it's also quite sensible as the defending car to, even if the person behind is doing this as kind of a sneaky dive, it's quite a good idea to leave them a bit of room anyway, because sometimes it will be real.
So if you've got a little bit of a pace advantage on the car in front, so put yourself in the situation I was with Van Gene. It's a guy who's not going to be a pushover, but for whatever reason, in that time and place, I've got a bit more pace. When I had failed overtaking attempts, I knew I was going to get back to him. So is it worth staying offline in your lunge position? So you're showing him your full front wing in the mirror and basically sacrificing a little bit of your entry to just go around and to continue that role play, if you like. Like, you don't necessarily want to dive back to the outside through their dirty air, if that makes sense.
Yeah, normally by that point, it's too late to change your mind and go back. You're kind of, you're taking a little bit of corner entry speed sacrifice for the opportunity to force them into an error. So you're not going to do it in a way which is going to massively slow you down. You're just hoping that that driver in front is going to leave half a car's width or a car's width that they weren't going to do before.
Okay, so let's keep with our theme of using the defending driver as our point of reference. So I've got Brad Philpott there, who I've managed to keep behind me for 14 laps because I've so improved my wheel-to-wheel prowess. You show me your front wing in my mirror. I don't want to let you by. How do I know when I do defend you? How do I know when to take my apex? How do I know when to leave you room, try and defend around the outside, and even when to yield?
Yeah, so the only surefire way to know is to actually see the other car in the mirror and be very aware of their position. There is obviously an element of judging the closing speed and the angle that car was going into the corner at. You can hopefully, depending on how aware you are and how experienced you are, work out where they're going to arrive. You're going to work out that, okay, I've pinched that driver tight there. They're going to have to have slowed down to a particular speed. Now I can cut back in because, you know, I was going X amount faster than them. But again, this is all down to, it's very situational, and it's very much down to how much information you've been able to glean in the preceding situation.
Okay. But you are defending, so you're going to take your normal braking point, maybe try and brake as late as you can to give yourself every chance of defending. As you get on the brakes, are you still on the brakes looking in your mirror judging, can I take the apex? Or is it too late by then? Do you have to, like, say, for example, turn one at Barcelona, when I was defending, I found I could go maybe another 10, 15 meters forward when I was defending around the outside, and that would allow me to then defend around the outside. So when are you making those decisions?
Yeah, so it's all completely real time. And us three, all in VR, have this big advantage over flatheads because you can just look. You know, if you're not sure, if the mirror isn't that clear, by the time you're in a wheel-to-wheel situation, I'm always just looking across at the driver next to me to change what I'm doing based on what they're doing. So if you can't see them, obviously you're going to have some kind of guesswork and leave a bigger margin. If you can physically look across at them and you know exactly where that car is, you can take a lot more liberty because you can you can really squeeze them, or, you know, you won't have to go as wide as you might have had to go if you were half guessing where they were.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I like just to pick a real world example that I think people will know. Barcelona, which is the next up and coming F1 Grand Prix. We've just done turn 9 over the top of the hill, nearly flat out to the right. And then we've got what is now the remodeled turn 10. So it's a long straight into a big stop zone. It's a left-hander, this particular one. We found ourselves on the outside in this situation we're talking about, Brad. You've showed the nose down the inside. Am I in the wrong place then? Generally, for that kind of turn, I'm on the outside. Have I given you too much of an advantage there? Because we were criticising Bottas at Portimao for not covering the inside. The second I've got Brad up the inside of turn 10 in Barcelona, should I already have been guarding the inside? When do I know how to move?
Yeah, pretty much. So that's quite a similar situation where you've got a tight hairpin left. So we were criticising Bottas at Portugal because it's such a tight left-hander. If a car dives down your inside, you are effectively hung out to dry.
Yeah,
they've got
done.
A much shorter line, and they will have the high ground as you exit the corner. Similar to that at Barcelona, the same corner, the same kind of corner you're talking about, tight hairpin left. If the situation arises quite late on and the driver is coming from quite far back and they end up roughly alongside you at the apex, you've still got some room to fight. They're pinched tight to the inside and you can hang on around the outside, and you might be able to get a better exit than them and get some, you know, get ahead again. But if they're alongside you or very close behind you as you're approaching the braking zone, it's probably too late
if you're
staying on the outside.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be so far past you up the inside that you'll have lost too much ground at that point. So there's two slight differences there. If they're braking late to get alongside you, the outside can be okay. If they're close to you already and they're braking to overtake you, it's too late. So you shouldn't cover the inside. So, yeah. Actually, as the defending driver, you need to work out what's best. Because if I'm defending from someone who's a little bit further back and they might make a pass attempt, I might stay on the racing line on the right and hang around the outside.
And leave just enough room if they get there.
Exactly.
But if we judge...
If they're really close, if they're going to slipstream past, I'm on the inside already.
Nice. That is actually useful information, Matt. I will apply that in the 10-15 race.
Yeah, well, that was one of the only overtakes I had was into turn 10, and I had to pass on the inside. And again, I found it to be terrifying because the person I could see was not really going to push their braking point any earlier. I wasn't going to be able to get back over onto the racing line, and I was still in a position where I was going to have to get the car stopped and turned with way less room than usual. And that's my normal thing is I always want to be as a defending driver on the line on the racing line, and I want to leave the other a passing driver as little room as possible to accomplish the maneuver they're going to have to maneuver to get ahead of me.
So let's say in this hypothetical situation you've not been proactive enough, you've been Bottas, And we've allowed the attacking car down that straight to get the inside, to get the positioning that they want. At that point, it's not all over. You can still, depending on the exact situation, providing they haven't actually got all the way past you by this point, you can still squeeze them. So you don't have to allow them the full width of the track. You know, you don't have to go back over to the right and give them two thirds of the track to make the corner as well as possible. You can keep them pinched on the inside and really make sure they have to go as slow as possible into that corner. So you're getting the maximum advantage to try and keep fighting it out at the next corner.
Sorry, Matt. A great example of that is turn one at the Nürburgring GP circuit, where actually it's tricky to break the way the ground is and the way it dives down into the apex. If you can keep that inside car uncomfortably, and on the marbles, I guess, if marbles are left on, a lot of cars struggle to get it then stopped, and you could just wait for them to fly past the apex.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm going to ask you about this because this is very related to what you're saying. If I have a car, let's say I don't get a great exit out of the last turn at Barcelona, I'm going down the straight and there's someone, they're not close enough to just get all the way next to me, but they're definitely going to have enough on me to make a move. A lot of times I will try and occupy the exact middle of the track and then I'll just see which way they are tending.
Like it.
And as they get closer, I will just start to move that way and make them go the other way and leave them as little room as possible to get round me that way.
Well, here, this is great, Brad. We're talking about what can you do on the straight.
Yeah, that's a very good technique, actually, Matt. Actually, quite an advanced technique. It's very good. So, yeah, you basically are becoming a bit unpredictable at that point. They don't know exactly which way you're going to go. They are hopefully assuming that you're not going to actually drive into them. So they know once they've committed to left or right, that you're not going to drive any further across than to where they are. But they have to make a decision. Do they want to go right or left? And down the main straight at Barcelona towards turn one is a real typical example of this. Kind of hovering somewhere in the middle and then just edging across to the side that they choose to go is actually a really good tactic. And if they were sensible, what they'd do is they'd pass you as close as possible to you to not allow you any room to move across. Because if they pass right. you on the right and there's a car's width between the two cars,
occupy that.
You can then right. pinch them up to the inside. Whereas if they pass you very close, a millimeter away from you, unless you actually make contact with them, there's nothing that you can do to make it harder for them at that point. So
right. I've been terrible here, Brad. I've been terrible. As soon as someone's picked a side, I've gone, if they go inside, I go, right, well, I'll just resume all the way to the outside and prepare for the corner. I shouldn't be doing that at all.
You should be doing that when you get to the corner.
Yes.
Because you want to basically give them no space until the last moment where you give yourself loads of space to try and really get the best possible entry to the corner and maybe cut back on them. So you give them no option but to break and enter the corner tight Brilliant. To the inside. For example.
This is all good.
You yourself have most of the track left to use when you decide to use it.
This is exactly what I hoped we would be getting out of this, like actual legit defense. Because a track like Montreal, for example, you only have to hold someone up for a few corners before they get in trouble with the cars behind. So I want to get Matt's thing clear that he was talking about. So Matt goes in the middle and he goes, right, you choose. They decide to go left. Let's call that the outside. Matt will then start to come over left with him just a little. Just to try and narrow that option. If he continues going left and leaves any space, Matt also goes left to occupy the space in between the two cars. And the guy has now, he's picked the outside, but he's got very little of the outside.
Yeah, so it's actually, strangely, the two different situations, whether they go right or left, changes the reason you're squeezing them. If they go to the right, you're squeezing them to disadvantage them as much as possible. If they go left, you're squeezing them to give you the most advantage right. possible into the corner.
Yes.
Because
assuming
you're
it's
trying
a right-hander.
To the...
We're assuming it's yes. a right-hander here, yeah.
Yes, at Barcelona, for example, this is where this is the case. So
Brilliant.
You're just trying to get as close to the racing line as possible so you can enter the corner as quickly as possible.
I love it.
Yeah, well, it's like the thing where if they choose to go that way, and you've accidentally left them enough room, you've got them pinned all the way against the edge of the track. So you have all the rest of the track to use for yourself. And because you're on the inside, you can pick a later breaking point and really disadvantage them. On the other hand, if they see that starting to happen and switch lanes, now you've made them go a lot farther around. And the moment you see them go to the inside, you don't move anymore. And again, you're denying them the usage of the track. And then you can swing outside, slow up a little early and try and cut back so as to get the jump on them around turn three.
Oh my God. I'm doing none of this, by the way, guys. So this is all such low hanging fruit for me. I'm doing nothing. I'm more or less just wavering people by or as effectively I'm doing that by not employing any of these techniques. So I can't get to wait to get out there and start exploring these. This is a rich topic. There's loads to go, and I've already made notes on future episodes because we've not even finished, not even close to finishing defending as the defending car. But the last topic I want to do here, because I do want to talk a little bit of kit. So briefly on this, Brad, let's talk Rosberg defending against Hamilton in Austria in the Red Bull Ring. I think it was 2015. We had loads of arguments about this at the time. So I want to know if I can do a Rosberg. So it was a right-hander. Hamilton's got the overspeed. He's round the outside. Rosberg's decided to hold the inside. They get to the apex roughly at the same time. But at the early part of the apex, what Rosberg decides to do is effectively not continue turning around the corner in his lane. He moves all the way to the outside of the lane. And they're roughly around the middle of the corner, slightly before the middle of the corner, by the time they get to the edge of the track, and Lewis Hamilton has been very firmly shown the outside. So that's very much like a block pass, I guess. How will that go down if I do it in F3, in iRacing, against you?
Yeah, so you are relying on the other driver not crashing into you. So we're just going to, I'll put that out there as a caveat. You're assuming the driver you're battling understands the situation and they are in control of their car. Because if you just did this on a kind of low split with a bunch of people you didn't know, you're running a very high risk of having a crash at this point. But we're talking about what you're allowed to do and what, when battling an experienced, good driver, would be acceptable or would work.
So I'm the inside car in all these scenarios we've been talking about, except rather than making a concerted effort to turn, I go all the way to the outside and effectively block you.
Yeah. So assuming you've left me just enough space to exist, so you've run me right out to the edge of the track. I know the corner is turning off to our right, but the track is wide enough that I'm just having to stay left because you're on my right-hand side. I can't go through you. So I'm having to wait to turn until you allow me to turn.
Yes.
That's absolutely fine and legitimate. And if you're battling me, I will not drive into you until we get to the point where I run out of space. So if there was a wall on the outside and you keep squeezing me up until the point where there's a wall, eventually I'm going to turn right. But if there's grass, I probably am going to allow you to force me off the track rather than make contact and just moan at you on the voice chat. But and at that point, you would be being out of order. And I would probably run you, you know, try and do something equally aggressive to you if I got back up to you. But I wouldn't turn in. Other drivers also shouldn't turn in. If there's a car next to you, regardless of how rude they're being, you shouldn't drive into them whilst you are still being given room to exist.
So iRacing's systems won't punish you, but I do that to you and it goes to Molden, Missed Apex Race Control for our series to be adjudicated later. Do I get any kind of punishment? Do I get a warning? Do I get told, hey, don't do that again?
You shouldn't do. You know, the other driver might say to you, oh, that was a bit rude. But in terms of what I would accept as acceptable racecraft, it's an extreme tactic. And it's something you would use on the last lap or on the last couple of laps when you're really trying to hold off a faster car at all costs. And it's about as far as you can go, but it's still legitimate in my eyes.
I would just add the caveat that if the car on the outside is unable to complete the turn because you went that far, then I see that as a penalty. And I see it as being very different as on the exit of a turn. If my front wheels are ahead of yours, I can pick my line on the outside and create that disappearing triangle, and you're eventually going to have to back off. So I can go straight, not turn right, make you go straight. But if I don't leave you room to get round with at least two wheels on the track, or at least one wheel on the white line, or whatever the rule is, then I feel like, for my personal sense of ethics, I have transgressed.
I think I find myself on Matt's side of things, which I don't like.
Yeah, so two things. I agree with Matt on the first point entirely. The limit, it becomes the point where the car on the outside can no longer actually make the corner. So I'm fully on board with that one. The second, the disappearing triangle on the exit, I don't actually agree with. If there's any overlap, you can't make the triangle disappear. I'm sorry. There's a car still next to you in my eyes.
Unfortunately, I agree with you, Brad, but F1 isn't stewarded like that, and they don't marshal it like that. And the Verstappen manoeuvre, and in fact, the Hamilton manoeuvre, because Hamilton used to do that to Rosberg all the time. He did it in Bahrain. He did it in Canada. Verstappen does it. Verstappen just did it at Imola to Hamilton, and Hamilton complained. It's like, no, dude, that's your move. He learned that from you. But because right at the top of motorsport, they don't penalise that, there is this impression all the way down through sim racing, karting and everything, Matt, that you're allowed to shut the door on the exit.
Yeah, well, to be fair, we rarely see that maneuver taken to the point where the outside car is four wheels off the track. Because usually if I've gone to the inside and I'm exiting ahead of you and my car is clearly pointed at that white line, the person on the outside of that recognizes the situation. They'll push it as far as they can, but they're not going to drive off the track just to make a point that they're going to lose anyway.
Brilliant. Look, we've got loads now, I think, that we'll actually have like a wheel-to-wheel segment of every episode. Good. I'm glad we're going down this path. Please, 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 just help me stop getting mugged in every single train I'm in. We will come back to attacking and defending in another episode. But I want to finish off, Brad, by talking sim racing politics, the world of sim racing. And you mentioned that you haven't had a rig for 3 weeks. Why?
Yeah, so we're not broadcasting video here. But
no.
If we were, as you guys can see, there is an empty space behind me where my VR headset's hung on the wall, but it's not next to a rig. And that's because there isn't one here. I'm not going to go into the full details because I don't want to mention any particular names,
in a negative way,
at least. But essentially, the agreement I had with my simulator rig sponsor is no longer agreed. So that rig has gone. And it was great. I really liked it, as I've spoken about on here before.
Yeah.
But fortunately, I have agreed a deal with their main rival, who, in my opinion, are better anyway. And I'm getting the top of the range version of their rig, and it's on its way to me right now.
But so, I already got Bradfluenced into getting the other one.
Yeah. So don't worry, because all of these aluminium high-end rigs are essentially the same. But what's different is, I think what people would notice the most is probably the customer service experience and the quality of the interactions between you and the company. So you fortunately didn't have any issues, I don't think.
No.
And I certainly haven't had any issues with, I can mention the good name anyway. So SimLab are the company that my new rig's coming from.
Now that I wanted the SimLab. I looked at the SimLab. It wasn't available in the UK and I was just a little bit twitchy about things getting stuck in customs or getting extra custom charges. Won't be a problem for you if it's being provided. I will say that I got mine through Demon Tweaks, and their customer service was like awesome. Three times I dithered while I was deciding, phoned them up, and some bloke was just chatting through like different needs and different seats and all that kind of stuff. So I had a really good experience. So I'll give Demon Tweaks a shout out. Not that they've given me a discount or anything, but you're sorted. That's the good thing. There's a rig on its way.
Yeah, exactly. And what's really nice is I didn't even go in and ask these guys to give me a free rig or anything. I actually was going, I kind of sucked it up, and I was at the point where I was just deciding, you know, if I'm going to have to buy a new rig here, I'm going to get the one I really want, which was, it's called a P1X. And when I spoke to a couple of friends, and they happened to know the main guy in charge of the company. And after saying to him, after giving him my story, and basically saying, I'm now without a simulator, he very kindly basically said, look, we don't want anything from you. If you think it's a good piece of equipment, tell people, but we're going to send you one right now. And so it's on its way.
Well,
so
brilliant.
I can't wait.
And look, I'm more than happy for you to, all contributors, I'm more than happy for you to talk about your partners and stuff like that and people who sponsor you. And I know that you'll give it an honest appraisal as well. So it will be interesting to get a side-by-side between those two brands. And I'm happy to talk about which brand is which in the future, when we're not so mardy at them.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm keen not to slate anyone. But the reason that this is interesting, and this isn't a politics thing, the reason that I'm particularly excited about this is because this has given me the opportunity to completely reprofile my simulator room. So I've moved a few things around and given myself more space. And I'm going to make this new one into a dedicated single-seater position rig. So the seat is no longer a GT-style upright seat. It's this new thing called a Sparco GP, which is, it is a simulator seat, but it's made by Sparco and it's made in a Formula One seat position. So very reclined. And I'm going to do my best to make everything ergonomically exactly as it would be if I was sat in a Formula One car.
But you, I mean, you are a GT driver. You are a sports car driver. You know, you're the Nordschleife class champion. Why are you going to have a rig that doesn't let you comfortably do that?
First of all, I don't tend to do a lot of practice for any car racing because there's not a lot of car racing happening. I don't think I'm doing anything this year.
Oh, no.
So it's all going to be karting for me this year. So the sim doesn't have to kind of reflect my real...
How's karting going for you so far? I don't want to tell any tales, but you've had a broken rib and a busted neck so far this year.
Yeah, so I'm just recovering from old person injuries, but it's going the right direction. Basically, I'm just super excited about being back in a car, and I'm going to be racing for a really good team at the next race. Yeah, it's been good. But anyway, the rig can obviously always be adjusted. So if I was training for Nürburgring 24 hours next year in a GT4 car or something, I can quite easily change it. But the fact is, the vast majority of my sim racing is doing stuff like you guys, single-seaters. So why not make it exactly right for a single-seater?
I'm wondering how much you think it will make a difference. I don't know about you, Matt. I am fairly able in VR to kid on that my legs really are up in the air. Like, once I'm in the position, it doesn't affect me too much. I can lose the fact that I'm in a GT seat position.
I don't know. I mean, I strap my wheel to a desk. I've got my pedals balanced on some books and wedged up against a wall. You know, you guys are playing in a completely different league than me when it comes to reality in your seating position.
If anyone is actually interested, I'm going to be live streaming the build. So it's going to be the most boring live stream ever, but I'll also make a proper, you know, time-lapse video of the whole process that you can watch in probably 3 minutes. But I'm going to put the whole like 8-hour build video just as a live stream so I can chat to people. They can tell me what I'm doing wrong. I can give them like my full live experience in the sim room here.
If you want, I will volunteer to guest as like a snooker style commentator. And he's reaching for the 8mm. That's a mistake. From here, from this distance, it is hard to tell. Looks like a 6mm from here.
Yeah, that'd be great.
We'll give some of that.
Head to my YouTube channel to watch that.
I mean, it's not the best plug of a YouTube channel I've ever heard. Watch me slowly build an aluminium rig for 8 hours.
Yeah, but it's about the interaction. It's about the chat. It's like being 4 laps down in an endurance race. You're not watching that stream for the racing, are you? You're just watching it to chat with people.
True.
If you're going to watch his YouTube channel, go watch his How to Drive the Nordschleife videos.
Yeah, man. We've got to the end of the allocated recording time. I did want to talk about very quickly, if we've got time. We've got 5 minutes. We've got a few minutes. Okay, so patrons bought me the load cell pedals. Very, very fantastic. Amazing. They were great, but it made the play seat challenge lift. It made the play seat challenge, it pushed the limits of what that could do. I got Brad fluenced into the rig, and then I got Brad fluenced further into buying that cheaper than my current T300. TSPC. Okay, great. So that's the three main elements, but I still have all the old gear. So my thing was just a comparison between the setup I've got now, and then I reassembled that old setup. I haven't sold it yet. I could maybe sell it as a complete kit, but it was the T300, the play seat, and the T3PA pedals with the load cell mod, which I bought secondhand from our friend Danny. And then going back to that, I went to Montreal in the F3, which is the track that we've been doing this week, to see whether or not I could replicate the lap times. And I got into the car. It felt fine. It's still a great piece of kit. The brakes are good. The wheel is good. The play seat challenge is good. But I couldn't get within 2 seconds of the time, Brad. And obviously, like, I didn't give myself hours and hours to get used to using those brakes again. I don't know exactly what it is, but my time was miles off. Another person, it wouldn't make a difference. For me, it did.
I have this exact same thing. I can't go backwards. And when I've tried even just driving with a screen or even triple screens, where in the past I would have just accepted it as normal and I never thought it slowed me down. Going back to that now, I really struggle. And I've actually even dedicated time to it, you know, really sat down to try and get close to my VR times. I'm just nowhere near. And I'm sure that would be the same if I went back to a, you know, if I downgraded to a TSPC or non-hydraulic pedals. But yeah, you know what I mean. Like, it's just hard to, one part of it is that you have the muscle memory and you're just used to a certain thing. It doesn't matter whether it's better or not. It's just, you're used to that. People have won world championships with a Logitech G25 in the past. But I think there's also an element of you're kind of used to the quality of the new version. It just does what you want it to a little bit better.
And your heart's not in it as well. There's a psychological aspect. You're like, oh, this isn't the thing that I want. So maybe before we sell that on, I'll give it another go. Maybe I'll do a bit more of a side-by-side comparison and a little bit more of a deep dive. I did mean to leave more time for this, but I know some people in the Slack group were just asking what was the headline figure. Couldn't get within 2 seconds of my current setup time. I'm sure I could improve that. I think we know what we're going to talk about in future shows. We're going to talk about the Fanatec, the Mini. We've touched on it a couple of times, but I think we'll get Brad's view on whether or not we should get that. We've got loads more defending and attacking stuff to talk about as well. And we've had Adam Rosales's question about gear shifting, which we've not addressed at all in this series. So pretty packed schedule ahead, Matt. I suggest we pick that up next Thursday.
I am looking forward to it because there are many, many questions. And I have found that changing the gearing sometimes in the car will gain me tenths of a second. So I can't wait to get to this subject.
Oh my God, I've not even thought of that. Lots to learn. Who'd have thought? I thought we could just learn everything about iRacing in 18 episodes of a Shed podcast. Turns out you can't. Follow me at Spanners Ready, please, at MattPT55 if you must, but definitely go and check out Brad's YouTube channel by searching for Brad Philpott on YouTube, where you can watch him slowly build things and presumably take breaks to eat pizza and stuff like that. It just doesn't seem like a good idea. I'm just saying.
I'm looking forward to it, just having some company, because it was very lonely last time I built one of these.
I'm just looking forward to you using the tools with a broken rib. I think that'll be the most entertaining part.
Just watching an aging GT driver going,
using his feet to try and make it, yeah, get tight enough. Yeah, it's going to be sad.
Excellent. Before we go down the feet and tooling foxhole, let's get out of here, guys. We'll see you next Thursday. Until then, work hard, be kind, have fun, and don't get Brad-fluenced. Oh my God, have you seen how many of our iRacing group have now got aluminium rigs since we've started talking about this? I think we should definitely get a cut from the major aluminium rig manufacturers. See if we can get like a discount code.
Oh yeah, obviously, if you're going to buy a SimLab, tell them I sent you. That's the other thing.
No, tell them I sent you. No, why is it all about you? Oh yeah, because you're a professional race driver and really good at SimDrive. Fine, whatever.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.